Okay, brethren, the subject that Brother David has chosen for this final discourse is, I think, a rather timely one. It is entitled Financial Turmoil and Prophecy. That's Financial Turmoil and Prophecy. Brother David.
Thank you, Brother Samson. Brethren, I think you have noticed what I have noticed in recent weeks, and in fact, going back even to the problems of 2008, there are financial distresses. And of course, there have been distresses and difficulties of many kinds for many years. But as watchmen, as people that know what the result's going to be, that is the introduction of the millennial blessing for all the families of the earth, and our eagerness to look forward to that establishment, we want to, as far as possible, keep apprised of the statement of the steps toward that result as we see them unfold. Sometimes it's hard, in the midst of looking at various immediate circumstances, to step back and get a perspective. In fact, sometimes it's not till years later that you can really get a perspective. Now, later we're going to talk about World War I and World War II. You know, when World War I broke out, I don't think the brethren was possible to get a perspective and see that this was the beginning of a two-stage war period that would last for decades. But now beyond that point, you can look back and say, okay, I can see that as a defined period of experience and prophecy and put it into focus. We'll talk about that more later. Well, likewise with the financial turmoils that we have seen hit the world. Now, I'm not one that likes to look at every single nuance of experience and news broadcast and find it in Ezekiel or Revelation. You know, you just can't do that. What you find in prophecy is broad experiences and broad movements and effects that will produce consequences. And you need perspective on this to see where that might be in prophecy. We're going to be looking at some areas of interpretation today that we submit for your best judgment. And who's to say if these are right or wrong? Well, that's easy to answer. You are the ones to say whether this sounds credible or not. And if it sounds credible, then it maybe will be a help to you, like it's a help to me, to keep my attention focused on the transpiring events and see how they mark our progress to the kingdom. Now, early on in the truth movement, that might not have been such a thing to do. Because as we'll find out as we review the experiences of world history, the first experience in the harvest was really the dissemination of the truth, and that's what the brethren were embroiled in. They really didn't look back and see the other developments we have listed on the board, many of which we have lived through. So it was hard to get perspective then and trace in every experience a progress toward the kingdom. They didn't have a clue, may I say, that there'd be another century beyond their expectations and more of unfolding developments, but now we know that. There's no question, we lived through it. Now we can look back and get a little perspective and see the phases of experience that are drawing us to the kingdom, because the kingdom is coming. There's no question on this matter. And if we can trace the experiences of the world and match them to the prophecy, we have a little firmer focus on where we are and what is yet before us. Now, we're going to have eight questions we're going to embrace in our study today. First, we're going to look at what are the significant world events since our Lord's return. Secondly, the prelude to Armageddon. Now, Revelation 16 talks about Armageddon, and it tells you what is the prelude to this. Now, we're not in Armageddon yet, but are we yet in the prelude to it? Do we see the faint beginnings of what's going to materialize? Thirdly, we're going to look in Exodus, the 10th chapter, to see the last plague in Exodus and the prelude to that, what precedes that. Fourthly, we're going to look at the experiences of Elijah and see if we can find some prophetic tie-ins today. Fifthly, we're going to look at the financial billows of the last decade and see if we can determine whether and how they fit into prophecy. Sixthly, the question, are more to follow? Or have we passed the heart of the difficulty? Well, the answer to that is no, we haven't passed it, but we're going to look at that question. And are the future ones indicated in Scripture? Seventh, how will this affect Europe and Israel? Because I think those two subjects are integrally tied together. And lastly, how will this affect the high calling and the truth movement?
Now, that's a lot of space we want to cover. Well, let's see how successful we are. First, what are the world events that have transpired since our Lord's return and that we anticipate in the future? Well, we have a list here of 7 items on the board that I think you can trace that don't seem out of line as far as historical perspective. The first 40 years from 1874 to 1914 were largely a period of the growth and dissemination of the harvest message to call out a people for God out of the systems and begin the harvest work. Now, we say begin. You know, they thought it would be the ending of the harvest work, you know, by those 40 years. And now we look back and we say, no, that was really the foundation for the harvest work, and it has gone onward and upward since. Now, I know the numbers don't seem like they're impressive, but you look at the places on earth where the kingdom message has gone since 1914, and the distribution has gone onward and upward. You know, most of the Romanian movement and the Polish movement, you know, really coming, expanding after the days of the early truth movement, and of course in the yet more foreign lands, even more so. After that, we had a period of war. We didn't know at the time, I wasn't even there at the time, but brethren didn't know at the time there would be another one. But there was a World War II that was even more destructive and more complete in its consequences. And between them, there was the punctuation of the Great Depression. Well, that gets us into our financial picture, and that tells us that financial turmoil really is a factor in the decline of the old world. Now, we passed that because we passed all of these problems, but they have left their lasting consequences even to this day. Now, in the recent financial turmoils, I have heard references back to the Depression and what they did or didn't do then and what they're going to do this time or not do as a consequence. This has its lasting implications even to our day. After World War II, we have a collapse of the colonial empires, not because somebody else came in and overran them, but because the cry for liberty and freedom swelled up. Now, you all remember the scripture in Luke 21. When you see the fig tree, I saw that blossom in 1948, and all of the trees, and we've seen an explosion of independent nations in Africa, in Indonesia, and all the colonial empires of Europe have begun to disintegrate and wean away. Now, was it in 1947? I'm not sure precisely when India got their independence. And that was followed with Israel in 1948, and in the 60s, a lot of the African countries and Indonesian countries. But I think maybe that wasn't capped off until 1989, when the Soviet Empire basically broke up. And we're in a different environment today. They even coined a new name for it, the New World Order, since the demise of the Soviet Empire. Now, when we were back there in 1989, looking at that, I said, this was unexpected. Now, some brethren looked back and responded to me, well, no, I kind of thought that might happen. Well, I'm glad. I didn't. I really didn't. I didn't know. But now it's observed fact. Now we can adjust our prophetic understanding at the basis of that observed fact. But in retrospect, it was the end of an era. And I think 1989, we'll see a reference to another prophecy that I think brings that into focus. Since that time, we had a decade of financial uptrending, let's put it that way. But then, at the end of the 1990s, coming to the year 2000, all of a sudden, bubbles began to burst. Now, there have been bubbles in the past, but now big bubbles began to burst. When we come to the year 2008, another bubble began to burst. The first one was the dot-com bust, and now we have the real estate bust. And I would have thought that would be localized more or less, but it didn't. It had its consequences worldwide because the financial fragment and fabric of the world is all so intertwined, it has its impact everywhere. And now we're discussing how the Chinese currency vis-a-vis the American currency will be into play and world stability. Everything's put together. So it's not hard to see that financial turmoil can be a decisive factor in shaping things up to the end. I think we're going to see something that even uses the concept of billows, sweeping swells of trouble that come in the financial world. I don't think we're through them yet, but we're in that period, and we have not yet got to the last and 7th major episode, and that is Armageddon. We're going to look now on point 2 to Revelation 16 about Armageddon and back up to see the prelude for Armageddon. What is it that immediately precedes Armageddon? Now, Armageddon appears only one time in the Bible. It's right here. It's Revelation 16. Was it Theodore Roosevelt as president that said something about standing on the brink of Armageddon and popularized this so that today, when you use that one text about Armageddon and refer to that concept, everybody knows you're talking about a final collapse. And I think that that is what it refers to. Now, I have sometimes said that the seventh plague of Revelation is Armageddon. And in recent years, whenever I say that, I am promptly corrected by a family member who says, no, that's not precise. And they're correct, it's not precise. Armageddon is really the first of three parts to the last plague. Now let's look at this in Revelation 16, verse 17. Verse 16 we'll start. He gathered them together into a place called in the Hebrew tongue Armageddon. The seventh angel poured out his vial. There were voices and thunders and lightnings, but then something else happened. Stage two. I think the first stage is the battle. And the next stage is the great earthquake, such as never was before since there was a nation. And now, in this great earthquake, Great Babylon is divided into its three component parts that came together in Plague 6. And the beast, dragon, and false prophet coalition did not stand. That is destroyed in the earthquake that follows the battle. And then finally, in verse 21, a great plague of hail falls out of heaven. And have you ever been in a hailstorm that was, frightening? Well, I'm in California. We don't have big hail, you know. But I remember being out on a barren mountain we were climbing in the back of our property when hail hit. And boy, it hurt. But that was nothing compared to what they get elsewhere. But that's nothing compared to what's here. These are 100-pound hailstones falling from heaven. Now, that's the final symbol of the final tearing away of what the residue that's after the battle and after the earthquake, that plague of hail. And I think it's a very intense symbol. It's not the light little hail, you know, that sometimes we have. This is dynamic sweeping away the refuge of lies in an intense way. But what leads up to all of this is plague number six. Plague number six starts in verse 12. The sixth angel poured out his vial on the great river Euphrates, and the water thereof was dried up, that the way of the kings of the east might be prepared. Now, the Euphrates, you may remember, was the river on which Great Babylon was built. As a matter of fact, the Euphrates went right through the middle of the city. The city was built on both sides of the river. They had gates going over the river so enemies couldn't come in that way undesired. And that's how Cyrus got in, by the way. He diverted the river, walked in underneath those gates, and he's right in the city. And he quickly takes over because they weren't ready to defend against it. So that's the symbolism, and that's why Revelation talks about the Euphrates, because we're talking about the collapse of the Western Christian world, Great Babylon, that's involved here. So what is the drying of the river Euphrates? Now, maybe you're like me a little bit. Years ago, I used to think, well, this would be like people not going to church so much, you know. But, you know, that's been going on for so long that I really don't think that's the dynamic point that is referred to in this prophecy. Now, Brother Parkinson mentioned maybe 40 years ago in a series of private studies we had with him and others that maybe the drying of the river Euphrates really referred to the economic withering of the power of the West. Now, at the time, I wasn't so sure about that. But it has grown on me as the years have gone by. Because what is it that the Euphrates did for Babylon? The Euphrates was what created Babylon. If they didn't have the economic trade that the river brought in, well, that was their lifeblood. That was their source of commerce, their source of wealth. That's what made Babylon the city, the lady of the nations. Now, if today the economy of the Western world begins to wither, will that be the beginning of a weakening that is going to lead to the last debacle? That seems to be the predicate here. Now, you remember before the Soviet Union collapsed, there was kind of the two worlds, you know, and we called nations that weren't aligned with that the third world. And usually the underdeveloped nations. But those two worlds, the East and the West, they competed, and they even had economic systems that competed. And may I say, one lost. There's no other way to put it. They realized that that system was not going to be able to match the output of the Western world. And so when that collapsed, even today, even the biggest communist power today, China, are really trying to get on a market economy. Maybe politically the other way, but market-wise, they want capitalism to really propel them to riches. Supervised capitalism. But they're doing pretty good at it. But imagine now, if the whole world turns away from that one system and towards capitalism, that's the great hope that the world has for their success. That worked fine for about a decade, and then cracks begin to appear, and a withering began to come in. Now, at the time that dot-com bust came, I really wouldn't have dreamed that that was a major beginning to a whole series of events. But looking back, that was the first billow that really brought us low. Now, 2001, you all know that one, 9/11. That was terrorism beginning to come in, and the market took another serious dip. And I think they worked in tandem to bring us low. But the world kind of recovered, not totally, but largely. And then 2008, this next billow, this next sea billow of trouble. Now, how bad was that in 2008? Well, I'm not an economist. I sometimes defer to Len Grice. He's not here. But you know, I don't even think the wise of this world know really how to control everything. They know more than I do, though. But I did hear a program in retrospect, a documentary about it, in which they said, had they not acted within a couple of days, they're not sure there would have been an economy to go forward. Now, that may be more radical than the facts allow. But that was the assessment of some very bright people. How bad was it? I don't know. But I'm glad there were people at the helm that did something to avert disaster. And we'll see there's a passage in Scripture that even refers to that fact, perhaps if we have time. But I think that we're not out of the woods. Maybe we're going to recover a little bit. And now what we have, the sovereign debt crisis, Greece, maybe not so sure they can fulfill their national obligations. No problem, let them go under. But no, but they have ties to the whole European community. So now the whole European bloc is involved. So they put up massive finances, and the American government has said, we'll start up the printing presses and make sure you're guaranteed. But some advisors are saying that's going to go from country to country to country, and then across the pond to the U.S. of A. So we'll see. We'll see. I think we do have more billows to go through. I think it might be some years ahead of us. Well, in Revelation 16, it says in verse 13, there's a consequence of this withering of the Western powers that I think takes years and decades to accomplish. But the consequence is society is weakened. And therefore, verse 13 says, the dragon, civil power, the beast, papacy, and the false prophet, Church of England and her Protestant allies, they're weakened. And so they have to lean to each other for support, to keep things going, to keep things in check. We're not there yet. We haven't reached that part of prophecy. The only point here is to show the connection. Because of the withering of the economies and the unsettling of society, the powers that be need to lean to each other for support and try to gird things and hold things together. That's the connection. There's the cause and the effect. And that, may I say, is an understandable reaction. But it's not the real answer. The real answer is the kingdom is coming. And beyond that, there's no real answer except for the kingdom. But verse 16 says, verse 14, when those coalesce, it's going to have an impact. They are the spirits of devils working miracles which go forth to the kings of the earth and of the whole world to gather them to the battle of the great day of God Almighty. In other words, the withering and the weakening of society causes the tendency to aggregate forces and to lean to each other for support. This collective enterprise directly leads them to the battle of the great day. There's cause and effect and another effect, and that leads to Armageddon. We're in the midst of that, may I say. I think that's where we are today. We're in those billows. But as it took maybe 40 years to go through this, and 40 or 50 years to go through the world wars, we've got some decades allotted for this. We're not on the doorstep of the kingdom quite. Before that comes, we have to gather to Armageddon. So we'll watch the progress of events and see how they tie in to the approaching problem of Armageddon. And we're going to hold that thought there, get back to that in a moment. But we're going to look to our third point. That is the plagues in Exodus. Because I think you remember the seven last plagues in Revelation are really drawn from the seven last of the ten in Exodus. In Exodus, those ten plagues, there were three early ones, and they were segregated by the seven last ones that I think are a picture of Revelation. So in Exodus, let's turn our mind's eye back. You remember, this is in Exodus, the 10th chapter. The death of the firstborn happened at midnight. That's like Armageddon. Remember that word midnight. We'll see that again in a few moments. But before the last plague, the death of the firstborn, what was there? There was a plague of darkness for 3 days, so intense that people could not rise from their house. What would you normally do to rise from your house? Go about your daily business and conduct your financial enterprises. That's what you do on a daily basis. That was stopped because of the plague of darkness. Now, does that tie in to the concept I heard so many years ago and now think is probably correct, that the sixth plague is a period of withering financial turmoil, the great river being dried up? I think so. I think that connects symbolically to a plague of darkness that inhibited the normal conduct of business. I think we find two different ways of representing the same concern. Now, remember those 3 days in that darkness. We'll get back to that again. We'll just plant that seed. But let's go back to the trouble in Exodus that was before that. Now, for this, we're going to go to Exodus, the 10th chapter, and see the plague that was before the darkness. This is in chapter 10, and it's from verse 1 down through, well, I guess it goes all the way through about verse 20. So it's long, and we don't have time to read it all. But you'll see there, this is the plague of locusts. This plague of locusts came from the east. That direction is important. It came toward the west, ate up every green thing, and then a strong western wind blew them back again. Now, when we began our interest in prophetic things, and I listened diligently to elders that were my seniors in the truth, and they were trying to figure these out and listened real well, and I didn't have a clue. Jim did. Jim Parkinson, my senior by some years, suggested this would be a conflict between East and West, resolved in favor of the West. What form it would take was uncertain. He had some speculations. But now let's look back and see what did happen. Then it was before it happened. Now it's after the fact. Has the West triumphed over the East in a substantial way? Yes. Has it been by a nuclear holocaust? No, thank God, it wasn't. But what did happen after World War II, when we were allies with Russia, that is the West, you know, we're allies with Russia, against Europe, against the Axis powers. Well, after that, during this period when the empires began to break up, during that time, the Soviet Union and their doctrines came from the East, came to the West, Middle and Central Europe. What happened to the green economies? It withered. They ate up every green thing. And finally, in the late 1980s, that strong wind of Western culture has blown them back. Now, when the Soviet Union fell apart in 1989, I was very engaged in thinking how this could apply. And some brethren thought at that time, and I agree with that, that this was the end of what we call the fifth plague. This was a closing of an experience where those communist doctrines had pretty much had their day. They had emptied Catholicism, Great Babylon, of her wealth and her treasure. And that's the whole point of the fifth plague. It's on the seat of the beast, papacy. Because their treasure was in Middle and Central Europe. And even in Western Europe, those doctrines and that kind of atheistic thinking ate away at the fabric of religious society. But the Western wind of culture pushed them back, and Russia, the Soviet Union, rather collapsed. Now that, we suggested, even the Romanian brethren are quite involved and quite intrigued with this approach because they lived through that, they saw the end of that plague, and now what's next? What's next is the withering of the economies. But for a decade we went through without any sign of that. Now we've gone another decade more And we say, have we seen any sign of withering economies? Well, have we ever? We've got those two bust, turmoil, and more apparently on the way. How soon? We don't know. So I think that gives impetus to say, yes, we are past that point. We are in the sixth area. We have not yet arrived to Armageddon. And this may be an area that lasts for some decades. I think we've been in that already for more than a decade. So maybe we've got some bills to go. But I think that gives us a little perspective on where we are prophetically. Number four, Elijah's experiences. Now, we've used this theme a few times in our lessons, so this might be familiar to you, and other brethren have as well. You remember Elijah when he had finished the 1,260 days of drought, picturing the times of the Dark Ages, and then the rain came again, picturing the Bible societies coming back, and Elijah had to flee for his life. Twice he was fed by an angel, maybe the Adventist movement, and then the movement of the seventh messenger. And then on the strength of that food, he went 40 days before he saw a sign of the trouble. So those 40 days that Elijah went probably are the 40 years of the early truth movement. And after that, he saw the vision of the winds sweeping over the hillside. Well, there's the winds of war, World War I and World War II. We're beyond that wind phase. I actually do not expect a third world war. Now, some brethren do. I'm open to their suggestions and their prophetic application. I think we're beyond the wind phase. I don't mean there won't be more wind. There won't be any more war. But we're beyond the major world wars that have climaxed and changed society. Armageddon's coming. That will be war. I do not expect it to be an east-west conflict. That's my own thought. So I think we're beyond the war phase. And after that came the earthquake. And the earthquake, social upheaval, didn't that happen when the colonial empires were broken up, shaken, and lost their colonies, and things really did change, so that they even said, we are now in a new world order from 1989 onward. I'll put a date there, not because it's sacred scripture, but because that's a date marking the fall of the Soviet Union that might be an end to that period. So the next thing that Elijah saw was the fire that would sweep over the hillside. Now, we often thought that fire to be anarchy. Well, I think that it is, but not a 1 or 2 year episode of total anarchy so much as the anarchistic tendency to overthrow the Western Empire that is fomented by an ideology. And that ideology we now see in bright focus from 9/11 onward, if we didn't see it before, which I didn't. And that is Islam. And I think that Islam is really the Islamic terror and fire that fulfills this prophecy. I do not expect this to abate until the kingdom comes. And finally we hear that still small voice speaking peace to the nations. I don't think the Islamic problem goes away until finally Abraham brings Esau and Ishmael and all of the other descendants together with Jacob and his descendants and says, let me explain what God has in mind here. And then there will be peace. Do you remember when Jacob was ready to come back to the land of promise, suggesting Israel coming back to the land of promise in our day? The last episode, before he met and embraced Esau, he was alone. He sent his family on ahead, and he was alone. He had a heavy heart. He knew he was going to see Esau, and Esau was coming with 400 men. You don't need 400 men to say hello. This was a threat. And Jacob was desperate. And so Jacob stayed there and prayed to God, and God sent an angel. And that angel appeared in the form of a man, and Jacob wrestled with him all night. What was he wrestling for? He had something in mind, because the angel said, the day is breaking, let me go. He says, I won't let you go till I get that blessing. Jacob was fearful for what was going to happen when he met Esau. Israel has been wrestling for that blessing of peace for ever since they were a nation and even before when they started coming back. Do they have it yet? No. When do they get it? Not until the break of the day does the angel give Jacob the blessing he sought. I think that means until the break of that millennial day, we don't see that peaceful embrace. And so what happened in the morning? He did meet his brother Esau.
They embraced, and they were friends. That's what's going to happen in the morning of the kingdom. We're not there yet. Until that point, that peace is elusive. And I think this terrorism spawned by the Islamic ideology is going to continue unabated. Therefore, we have on two sides of the coin during this period of time not only economic billows in the West, but terrorism as a political ideology that's going to absorb the West. I think we've got those two things going on at the same time. And those will not end until finally we get to the Armageddon climax. Now, there may be dips and pauses, but I don't think we're going to find an end until we get finally to the Armageddon climax and then the kingdom that follows. Now, I'm not politically involved, but I do observe. And I just observe that the president that we have, almost predictably perhaps if you look at his background, is involved in large expenditures with an adeptness towards taxation and printing money. That's just the way he is doing. And on the flip side, he's more attracted, I'll put it this way, to Islamic concerns than any president has ever been. So I think what we have brewing right now is somebody in office that is intimately part of both of these issues, the financial on the one hand and the Islamic terror on the other hand. Now, what happens with the next pharaoh to come along? I don't know. We just keep watching because things are undisclosed that are ahead of us. Number five, the financial billows of the last decade, how do they fit into prophecy directly? Well, we've answered that partially by saying that's the sixth world event of magnitude leading toward the kingdom. I wouldn't have said that 20 years ago. I really didn't grasp. Now, it's for you to judge whether you think this is credible. I think that it is. I think the financial upheavals are very much their own distinct segment of this world's orders that are weakening the fabric of society, the withering of the river, to lead to some effort to stabilize society that won't work, prove abortive, lead us right into Armageddon, and then finally, the kingdom of Christ. Well, now, how is that going to work? How is financial instability going to lead us to Armageddon? Well, I'm borrowing a little from some of the points coming up. Now, I better pause. I won't go there yet. We'll get back to that. Let's go now to Acts, the 27th chapter. Some of you know that I am intrigued with the concept that Acts chapter 27, as many chapters in the book of Acts, are actually carrying a prophetic meaning to it. This is not original with me. I heard this thought 30, 35 years ago, whenever. It has grown on me, and I'm quite attracted to it. And the people who decide whether it's credible are the audience that's listening. But I would suggest that in Acts 27, as Paul is wending his way towards Rome, the center of world government, he is still subject to the powers that be, that this is a picture of the church during the harvest of the gospel age making their way to the center of world dominion, where the church is going to rule and reign with Christ during the millennial kingdom. And that the episodes of his trip on the way tell us the things that we are going through during this experience of the harvest that match the other prophetic areas. Now, we can't read the 27th chapter. It's just too long. The time is too short. So we're just going to tell you what it says there. And we're going to use this little map to outline what's happening. They start off from Caesarea under a centurion whose name is Julius of the band of Augustus. Everything about this is about the Roman authority. I think this is telling us that you and I, as the Paul class, as the Lord's people, were under the rule and the jurisdiction of the powers that be still. Now, finally, we're going to be ruling with Christ, but not yet. We're still subject to the powers that be. The first leg of the trip takes them to a place called Sidon, which, like Tyre, their sister city, I think represents a place of Christendom, but a place from which the truth movement expanded, and that's the Protestant segment of Christendom from which the truth movement expanded. Very surprisingly, Paul was set more or less at liberty here to refresh himself with the brethren. Now, this is shocking to me a little bit. You know, Paul must have been an astounding character. His Roman centurion captor let him go have fellowship with the brethren at this port of call. Now, I think if I was in that situation and I asked a Roman centurion, would you mind if I went to meeting?
He'd slap me on the face and say, how dare you ask? But Paul was a remarkable person, and he allowed him this. And I think this is a little indicator that the first experience of the brethren during the harvest was going to be a sweet blessing of fellowship with those of like Christian faith. I think that's the first 40 years of the Truth Movement. And then, as in Elijah, when that was done, the winds of war begin to hit them. The narrative says as soon as they left there on the way to Myra, they encountered winds, and they went through two seas full of winds, Cilicia and Pamphylia. Have we, since 1914, gone through a period of wind? I think so, and we've gone, as a matter of fact, through two seas of wind, World War I and World War II. And at that place, they changed ship, just as after 1945, with the old kings and their vestiges gone, we've changed the ship of state. Europe is not the same after World War II as it was before then. It's changed. But not as much changed as it's going to be. They left there under a new ship, a ship destined to ruin, may I say, and they went on to the last port of call on the very extremity of the old mainland. And I think that's a place called Knidos in the scriptures. You find it even today. It juts out on a peninsula, the last port of call you could make before you leave the mainland. Maybe that represents the next episode when we leave every vestige of the old world and get into the new world order, with communism retracing their steps and the Soviet Empire, the last of the great empires, to really break apart. So we leave there, and what stands us from there? I remember in 1989 thinking, what remains as we sail on into the kingdom? Maybe it'll be close at hand. But it didn't work that way, did it? Here we are 20 years plus beyond that time. What did happen was winds came up, some more wars. This time it was in the Gulf states. America became embroiled in that. And I remember when the first Gulf War came, thinking, is this a blip on the radar or is this meaningful? I don't know. But now with perspective, we've gone through Iraq 1, Iraq 2. We're not out of that yet. There's the Afghanistan. I don't think it's a blip on the radar screen. This is part of the whole Islamic problem that we're facing still in the present time. Now, when he's traveling from there, it says they barely passed a place on the Cretan coast where they went for security because of these new troubles. It says they barely passed Salome. Salome means, that's where I got that word. It means billows. That's where the billows begin to roll in. And billow after billow after billow, the ship was in danger, but they made it. It says they barely passed there, and they were able to reach a point of security on the underbelly of Crete, called, appropriately enough, I mean, if you're writing this as a book, you couldn't think of a better name. Fair Haven. It was a place where they could get some respite from those buffets and those turmoils. I don't think we're there yet. I think we're going through those billows. You're the ones to decide. But I think we're not yet to Fair Haven. I think this speaks of the fact that maybe after another decade or so of more financial buffetings, more problems, maybe we're going to reach some stability. Stability does not mean riches. It does not mean former glory. It means just that, stability. And at that point, Paul tells them, you ought to stop here. Don't go on to the next port of call, which is a place called, as we know in the southwest of America, Phoenix. And that Phoenix, way on the tip of Crete, it says, was a more commodious place for them. I think this shows they want to get on and regain some of their former glory. And Paul says, don't do it. It's not going to work. You should just be thankful for what you've got. But the shipmaster and the centurion outvote him. They head out, and immediately they're swept out to sea, and they almost can't control the boat. They're caught up into 14 days of turmoil, of darkness. Darkness? Well, that's the plague that immediately precedes Armageddon. They're swept into 14 days of darkness. But 14, that's not... Now, what was it back there in Exodus? It was three days of special darkness, remember? But if you read the account, this is Acts chapter 27, verse number 15 through 19. It says, they were so buffeted, they could barely get in command of the boat, and they undergirded the ship. on the first day. And on the second day, they lightened the load, maybe dumping some cargo. And then it says in verse 19, the third day we cast out the tackling with our own hands. There's the 3 days. The 3 days of darkness and special despair are 3 days just like in that ninth plague of Exodus. 3 days of darkness, total despair. Now you read on, and it says they just gave up hope. Things were so bad, they didn't know where to turn. They thought they were all going to die. And may I say that after, we'll watch and see how this unfolds. But if this is right, if another decade brings us more billows, and then we have a place of security, may I say at that point, is that 10, 15, 20 years down the road? At that point, I think it's time for the work of the high calling to begin closing down. Now, I see from our time and from the things coming ahead of us, we're going to have to mix a little bit some of our comments. But I would just say that at that point, Paul says the fast of the Day of Atonement had passed. And that means winter time is coming. What's winter time? Pray that your flight be not in the summertime, but be in the summertime. Pray that your flight not be in the wintertime. Pray that you get out before the winter comes. Because when the winter comes, the great company says, the harvest is past. The summer is ended. And here we are. We're still here in the wintertime of trouble. And we're not yet saved. That's the great company going through the difficulties of Revelation 7, purging their robes. So during that time, it says the winter was nearing. And Paul said, stay here because the Day of Atonement is past and the autumn is upon us. The Day of Atonement was the time for the sacrifices. Is this a suggestion that maybe the age of sacrifice then will begin to close down somewhat? Do you think the high calling is going to be raging forward 1 year before the kingdom has come? I doubt it. You need more time for people to develop. That may be very important. I don't know. But that probably is going to be about the time when the work of the high calling begins to subside. I don't think we're there yet. I think we've got another 2 decades perhaps to go. And I think we should be onward and upward and focused on the work that we have to do as much as possible. Now, you remember going back to Elijah? There was the smiting of the Jordan, and then later Elisha smote the Jordan a second time. Well, maybe that first smiting has something to do with another step forward in promoting the truth. We'll see. We'll see what happens. We'll see whether that works or not. Question number 7. How will this affect Europe? And how will this affect Israel? Well, think with me about what's happening today in Europe. They have come together after decades of planning, and they have a common currency. Right? The euro? Now it's some question how long this will continue. I suspect the euro will make it through, and it will continue pretty well. But their next effort is to have a common foreign policy. If they achieve that, I suspect they will in the decade or so. Do you think Europe is going to take a position in favor of Israel or more negatively on Israel? I think probably the answer is more negatively. Now, I'll give you a scripture you can look at later on. It's Revelation 17:12, and it says, now this is the extremely paraphrased version, the powers of Europe will coalesce for a brief time to work their political will. That's the David Rice translation. That's really an interpretation. But if you look at Revelation 17:12, it says the 10 powers of Europe will coalesce for some purpose. I think at that time, they are going to draw closer to their affinity with Gog from Russia, and that in fact, Israel will suffer the consequences. Ezekiel 38, that you remember, verses 5 and 6, says that when Gog comes down against Israel, he has allies. And some of those allies are ones you would expect. Now, do you think Persia, Iran, will be against Israel in that conflict? Probably. And it links Persia or Iran as confederate with Russia. Do you think Libya would be with Russia against Israel at that time? I'll bet you they would be. And sure enough, Libya is in that coalition. Turkey, Togarma. Now that's a surprising one. Turkey really wants to be part of the West. But you know, the West has said, you know, culturally, I don't know if we mesh. And now Turkey's going towards the East. And I think probably Turkey and Israel are getting along more poorly now than ever. Turkey's going to be in that camp to be part of the invader. But the one that is the most opaque is Gomer. You'll see this in Ezekiel 38, verse 5 and verse 6. It says Gomer is part of the coalition. Gomer may be that people that later became Germany, fanned out across Europe, and became Western Europe. So if the powers of Europe do coalesce, like Revelation 17:12 says they will, maybe that will be part of the coalition against Israel. And I think, therefore, every step we see from now on in Europe becoming more and more a unified power will speak more and more unfavorably about Israel. And finally, it will crescendo at the time of Armageddon. Well, let's pause and kind of take a perspective on what we've looked at today and summarize and see what's before us. We've seen a number of threads of prophecy that seem to be intertwined. We've seen in Revelation that there are seven distresses that come upon the Christian world to bring them low and introduce the kingdom. Are these those seven distresses that have weakened each one of them, some part of the Christian world? Possibly it is. In this sequence, we have seen the collapse of world empires. We are now going through some impressive financial billows. And this is weakening society until the time when they're going to have to undergird that ship, bring it into control, take some stronger measures. Now, I'm not one that believes that the Dark Ages will be repeated. I think that's behind us. I think the 1260 days ended that period. But what Revelation does say is that there will be an effort by the powers as they weaken to lean to each other for support. And when this happens, it'll be the imminent precedent for leading the nations to Armageddon. Now, how does that tie in? How does it tie in that the financial problems are going to lead to Armageddon? We dangled that thread earlier. We're going to come back to that and try to fill that in. Well, this is the way I think it works. I think the financial turmoil causes the unification of parties, the undergirding of that ship, and then the suggestion, that if only we could solve that flip side of the issue, the Islamic problem, if we could cure that, maybe we could tranquilize society and be on our way to financial growth again. So it's going to be an issue. Still, it is already. But increasingly, how to solve the Islamic problem. And one way to do that was to impose a solution in the Middle East to get rid of the Israeli-Arab problem. Not necessarily to vacate Israel, but to impose their will upon Israel. Will Europe and Gog together take this position? I suspect that that's what prophecy is telling us. Will the United States join in that position? I don't think that's what prophecy tells us. I think the United States and perhaps England are on the other side. Tarshish, the old lion, and her young colonies, they say to this invasion from the north, what are your intent? What are your plans? What are your purposes? Are you come to take a spoil? Suggesting that they are not sympathetic to this. But if this happens, if the invasion of Gog comes with a host of foreign countries, do you think the United States today or in the future is going to say, let's have at it. Let's come to war and see who would. You know, I don't think so. I think they're going to be overwhelmed and say, this is too much for us. And so what is Israel going to have when their back's to the wall? Only one hope. And that is, they've looked every direction. They've got to look upward. That's the only place there's going to be a solution. So I think this is what's coming. And I think the financial turmoil we see is just the beginning of some problems that are going to ebb and flow as sea billows do before finally they reach their climactic impact. Each turn of the road, we can't say. But there are going to be privileges of service for the church. And this gets us to our last point. How will this affect the truth movement? Well, I would just say that in Acts, the 27th chapter, as Paul is approaching the shipwreck, which I think is a picture of Armageddon, Paul is visited by an angel at night. In fact, this is Acts 27, starting with about verse 21. After a long abstinence, Paul stood in the midst of them and says, you know, you should have listened when I said don't set out on this venture. But you did. And now verse 22, I exhort you to be of good cheer. There shall be no loss of any man's life among you, of course, except for the ship. Ship is going to be destroyed. You will be saved. How does Paul know that the ship is going to go to destruction and the people will be saved? Remember, they all gave up hope. They despaired of ever coming out of this alive. Now Paul says, you're going to be saved because an angel told him. And he says, I believe that the God who sent that angel is true. Well, now, what do we think about the coming problem? Is the ship of state going to ruin? Yes. Are the people going to be saved? Yes. In a wonderful way, through a 1,000-year kingdom that only we know about. Nobody else on this ship knows. Only the Lord's people. Now, how do we know that? An angel visited us. That would be the seventh angel of Revelation. And he told us the beautiful message that the kingdom is coming and the world will be saved. That's how we know. We've had a nighttime visitor. But they come, everybody takes heart. Is this possible that when the crescendo of events come and the world is in despair, 14 days of darkness, they've given up hope, will they be receptive to a message of the coming blessings? I think maybe they might be. Maybe this is an opportunity for that final message of encouragement from the Elijah class. We'll see. Then the nights pass on, and they near the island that's going to register a disaster. The ship's going to be broken, and it tells you exactly what time it is. It says, this is in verse 27, on the 14th night as we were driven up and down in the Adria, at midnight, they realized we were in jeopardy. You remember those Exodus account, the plague of darkness, and then finally the death angel hits at what time? Midnight. There's the hour of disaster. Sure enough, disaster strikes. The ship is lost. They all swim to shore on a tiny island. They're all saved. Paul begins to heal everybody and preaches the good news of the kingdom. There's the kingdom. There's the way the story wraps up. So we'll keep our eyes open. We know the final end to come. We know that after the distresses that come upon this world, there will be a blessed time of relief, of healing, and of blessing for everyone who has ever lived. We know we've got some dark periods to pass through. We know the prophetic word is replete with indicators. Whether we can match them all up or not, we will see as time passes. But we do want to keep our eyes open, keep alert to the possible signs, appreciate that even with the difficult experiences that we share with the world, that we have another focus on them. And that is that these are telling us the kingdom is near at hand. And that's the blessed news that only you can know and share.
Wow. Thank you, Brother David. It's good to know that even though as right now there's storms plenty around, that there will be joy in the morning. Okay, we will wrap up this with the singing of hymn 213. And those who are able will rise on the last verse.